This episode of Registry Matters is proudly brought to you by our amazing pledge patrons, Justin, Brian, Michael, Joel, James. Your support makes this podcast possible. Thank you, and don't forget, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 352 of Registry Matters. What's up, man? How are you?
Doing awesome. I'm glad you made it back from your lovely weekend or week at the beach.
It was quite delightful. And we had a little bit of a miscommunication. Sorry about that. I swore we were not recording tonight because you told me there was not anything going on. So I was sitting on the couch watching television. But here we are.
That shows the dedication of the many, many workers who put together this quality content from coast to coast.
And the dedicated people are you and me, which mostly you for putting the content together.
So you don't think we have a team dedicated from coast to coast working on this?
Yeah, we have a team of you and me. Yeah, that's a team. It's pretty much coast to coast with some gaps in between.
Yep.
We do have one dedicated patron listening to us live. Thank you very much for joining us. And you're on time, which I know you're going to leave us in a moment and go have dinner. What are we doing tonight, Larry?
Well, you forgot to tell people to sign up.
Well, please head over, like, subscribe, 5-star ratings, notification bell, share it. If you're over there on the subreddit for the PFR subreddit, please thumbs up when I post the episode on there and everybody will be super happy about it and we can drive more listeners in here. There. Now, what are we doing tonight?
Well, I hate to break the studio audience heart, but it's just Mr. Doom and Gloom Chance cannot be with us probably until later this month. He's got other conflicts, so it's just me. But we have a case from the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. It's not a huge win for PFRs yet, but it could become so in the near future. Also, we have a belated phone message that I should have covered months ago. And we have a question from Frank about your favorite topic, the Kabuki machine.
I like the Kabuki machine.
And also, we have an article that I'd set up for Chance, and it was intended to be covered by him. But since he's not here, it'll be Mr. Doom and Gloom for that as well. So I think we've got a little bit of content going tonight.
Fantastic. All right, well, let's dive right into the letter, the handwritten letter from Frank, and it says, Dear sir, please forward this to the Legal Corner. A couple of years ago, NARSA published an article regarding polygraphs and our rights. To avoid the yes-no trap and the issue of self-incrimination, you suggested we respond, I request that my attorney respond to that particular question. Can we still use that? Is this still a good method of defense?
Well, what caught my eye about that, I've been intending to cover that, was that I generally write all the things legally for the NARSA newsletter, and I don't recall writing that. Because yes-no questions are the way the polygraph is designed. It's not a narrative.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's so, not an open question of, hey, can you tell me what you did last year for Christmas? It's like, that's not going to be a yes or no. Is your name John Doe? Yes. That's how that works.
That is how it works. I can't imagine that I would have written anything of that nature. But in terms of Frank's question, I'm not a big believer in being at the polygrapher's office and saying my attorney should answer that question. That's why I don't think I wrote that. That is the quickest way to get yourself a violation of supervision if you were to do that.
You don't think they'd find that funny?
Well, I would agree with you. You say nothing's funny. This would not be funny. I can't imagine who the attorney was that wrote that, that said that, and how it escaped my scrutiny, because really, they're a practitioner and they tell a person, you can't take your attorney to a polygraph exam. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
No, I can't. I would like to bring my attorney with me to these questions, and he's going to then answer for the ones that would incriminate me.
Now, That having said that, Frank, you do not give up your right against self-incrimination. That is something that you can do, but you've got to do it very judiciously. We had a case in Georgia early on in this program's history where the guy told them what they could do with their polygraph. You remember who I'm talking about, don't you?
I do.
He wasn't going to take any polygraph questions, wasn't going to be examined at all. That's not the correct way to invoke your right not to incriminate yourself, because the entire exam may not be incriminating. It's only a particular question that might incriminate you. So each question has to be evaluated in the pretest interview, and you would tell the examiner in that situation, I won't be able to answer that question because. And then all the furniture on the Titanic's deck will shift like you've never seen before, and they'll start pushing buttons to get the probation officer in there. And they'll threaten you with all sorts of bad things if you don't cooperate with the exam. That's what will happen if you do that. But if you don't want to go to prison for incriminating yourself, you just have to stand firm and say, I can't answer that particular question, but I am cooperating with the exam except for that question.
Now, let me dig into this a little bit. Can you help them, encourage them, whatever the terms we want to use there. If the question might be too broad, then it can be, you can get them to focus it so that you don't have to answer to something. Do you see what I'm saying? Like if
Oh,
they, I don't know, if they ask you, did you do the bad thing to this person? You could get them to be more specific, et cetera, or less specific in a way that you can answer it, where you're not going to ping the Kabuki machine.
you're correct. And I had that experience myself with the one and only PFR exam I took, as the question needed to be narrowed because they asked, have you ever had any sexual activity with someone below the age of consent? And I told them that's not a good question. What do you mean we ask that all the time? And I said, well, you make a mistake all the time if you're asking it, if you're phrasing it this way.
I'm
I said,
laughing because you're directing them of, if that's how you're asking it, that's not a good question.
and I said, so we got variables here. I said, first of all, I need to know, was I above the age of consent at the time I had the sex?
I see what you're saying. But couldn't the
And
law have changed also in the time that they're asking the
yes,
question?
that's where I'm headed. I have been here a long number of decades, and the law has changed. When I moved here, the age was 13, and I was considerably younger than I am now. And at the time when the age of consent was 13, I was in my early 20s. But still, it would have been unlawful if they were below 13, but it would have been completely lawful if they were above 13, even though I was in my 20s. And I told him, I said, so you need to phrase the question like this. Have you, since achieving the age of majority of 18, knowingly had sex with anyone who was below the age of consent at the time you had the sex? I
Right, I
said,
gotcha.
and they agreed to modify the question. Because I said, otherwise it can trigger a response, because I have had sex with people under the current age of consent.
I mean, this is making me, it's reminding me of the, is it Doug Moore that was the somebody in Alabama and he was catching all kinds of heat for 40 years ago having a relationship or whatever that was? Is that the guy's
Yes,
name?
that was the Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy Moore.
And so looking back in the 70s or 80s, the age difference wasn't looked at the same way that it is now.
That is correct. If I remember right, he was a young person himself, and he was working at a restaurant called the Old Hickory House, and he had maybe worked up to where he was a supervisory type person, but he had sex allegedly with someone underage. And it was just nothing but rumor and gossip and malicious attack on him, because there's no way he could defend himself. You can't find someone from the 1970s that you supervised as a teenager and find all the people to find out if that was consensual or not. I mean, it was just crazy, but that's what they did to him because they're looking for ways to discredit him.
Right. And so let's go back to Frank. So if they are going to, so anyway, if they start asking you questions like, what is your name? Do you live at this address? Those kind of control questions. And then they're going to hit the specific ones that would entrap you in a sense. You need to answer all of the ones that you can, and then work with them to make the question not roast you for the ones that that are going to, well, roast you.
Correct. And that should be determined in the pretest interview. They don't just hook you up and start asking you questions. You are apprised of what the questions are going to be in advance. If you're not apprised of those questions, then you're not taking a bona fide polygraph exam from accredited examiner. I don't know for what you think about it, but still, there's a process to do it. And that's not the process if they just wire you up and start asking you questions without you having any idea what's coming at you.
It's just funny because to me, here's the placebo aspirin. And if you are not taking a bona fide placebo aspirin and it doesn't make your headache go away, then you're not taking a, it's pseudoscience and it's not real. It's all in your head. And so we're talking about a real thing in your head. Got it.
Well, there's a process to follow for the polygraphy business. And I don't know that it deviates anywhere coast to coast. And so if you are hooked up and they just start asking you questions, that's totally junk.
I gotcha. All right. I think that was fantastic. That was a lot of fun, Kabuki Machine. All right. Well, then we will head over to this question from Derek. And I remember sending this to you, like, I don't know, a decade ago.
Well, I don't think it was quite that long, but I do feel bad about it. It's lingered for months. I totally lost it until it popped up into my briefcase last night. I was going through trying to make it lighter and throwing out cases that I take home to review. You know, they're 30, 40, 50 pages. And
yeah, sure.
I had printed this with the intent of calling Derek, and then it fell off my radar. So, Derek, I apologize. I intended on calling you, but you wouldn't have answered your phone anyway, but still I intended on calling you.
Nobody answers anymore. Well, this is what he said. He said, I'm a longtime lurker and Patreon contributor to Registry Matters. The amount of time and effort that you, Larry, and Chance spend on this critical issue is incredible, and I'm very appreciative of it. I do, of course, have a registration question that I need help in determining what my next steps should be. If you have a couple minutes this week that I can lay on you, that would be awesome. I live in Texas, charged with possession of CP at the federal level. One count, but I still have to register for life here in Texas. I've made peace with it. Now, I have been with my partner for over 5 years. We actually knew each other before I went to prison, but he didn't know what I was doing illegally. Anyway, we finally met up at the end of 2019, and he lives in Indiana, and he's on disability. He has been amazing because for 5 years now, he has split his time flying between Texas to me and going back up to handle the rest of his affairs. His being on disability hurts his opportunities in Texas to get the same level of care that he's getting in Indiana. There's currently a 3-year waiting period to get Medicaid through Texas. He owns his own place in Indiana, inherited through his grandmother, but his place is right next to a public park. I thought Medicaid was federally funded. Was it his 3-year wait? What is this 3-year waiting list about? Is that actually something that to get your Medicaid like transferred into Texas, it'll take multi years?
It can, and I learned that with my sister moving from Florida to Georgia, but she had an ex-Medicaid friend that had worked in the bureaucracy, and they were able to cut that wait down to just 30, 45 days. But it's jointly funded by the federal government, and the states share that with the federal government, but the federal government picks up the larger share. And many states do have waiting lists for Medicaid. So you don't just because you're eligible magically get on it. It's kind of like Section 8 housing. Everybody says, well, go get Section 8. Well, there's a 3-year waiting list, so you don't get on it right away.
All right. Well, then he went on to say, Indiana has a 1,000-foot residency restriction that they place on SVPs and offenders against children. I found that they also give a clear definition of what constitutes an SVP, an offender against a child. But when my partner called the Allen County Sheriff, they completely shot it down without my partner even giving him my name or case number. I'm pretty sure that the sheriff was giving incorrect information. Now, I'm not looking to pick up a registry violation. However, what would be the best way to re-approach the sheriff?
Well, I still do need to speak with Derek for a point of clarification, but it sounds to me like Texas intends to enforce Indiana's PFR restrictions. And I'm not sure they can do that because Indiana is no longer in control if he were to move to Texas. So that's a question we need to resolve. Is this a Texas law that says that that he can't live there because he mentioned the park in Indiana. And if he's living there, then obviously it's not a problem in Indiana, right?
No. What the way that I'm reading this is that he's going to try to move to Indiana to be with his partner, and his partner lives next to a park, and there's the 1,000-foot restriction. So him moving to Indiana is going to be a challenge. That's what I'm reading.
I read just the opposite. He was going to move to Texas.
But he is already in Texas.
No, but the partner's not.
The partner's in Indiana, and the partner's going to move to Texas, and that's where the Medicare whatever thing kicks in.
Well, that's what where we're saying the same thing, though. But okay. It seems like that Texas is trying to enforce Indiana's restrictions, and I'm not sure they can do that because Indiana would no longer be in control. But the question would be, that's my first question, do I have this right, Derek? Is that what we're talking about? And then the next question would be, does Texas have a provision in their law that requires them to enforce another state's registration requirements? As wacky as Texas is, they're right behind Alabama in wackiness. But I wouldn't be surprised, as a deterrent to keep BFRs out of Texas, they would put something like that in their code that says that whatever restrictions in another state would follow you there. But if they've gotten that in their code, that is within a zone of constitutional challenge, because there's also the full faith and credit and equal protection clause and all that. And the equal protection clause, if he becomes a resident of Texas, he has the right to be treated like a Texan.
I understand. So with what we know, what do you recommend for Shore?
Well, we need to do the point of clarification. So he can either call in again or agree to answer his phone and I'll call him now that it's come back on my radar. But we need to know that clarification, and we need to have a legal opinion once we ascertain the facts, which I can get from an attorney in Texas. Do they have that provision in their law that they enforce out-of-state restrictions? But this is quite interesting. He can't live with his partner. Because Allen County Sheriff said, no way. And it's like, really?
Now, just from what you remember of this, and is he just, quote unquote, just on registration, or is he still under some kind of supervision?
That point's not clear also. But by the way the voicemail was constructed, it's fairly certain that he's not under supervision, because he said he's been commuting back and forth for 5 years. And I can't imagine them letting him go back and forth to Texas if he were under supervision to see another PFR. I just can't see that being approved.
I don't think his partner's a PFR. Yeah, we need to get clarification, because I think we're reading different things out of this. I think we are. I don't think his partner is any kind of PFR. He's just somehow he met him and he's in Indiana. That's what I've got.
Anyway. Yeah, I can see how you're reading it that way, but I don't see if he's a non-PFR, what the hell this has to do with anything, because it's just like anybody else moving. Whether does Texas tell you who you can live and be in love with and who you can be?
Texas? Really? I can imagine that they would have an issue with a PFR living with a dude. I can totally see that.
No, not
because we don't. This is a state of Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Come on, man.
Not a state that believes in individual liberty and all that kind
really
of stuff.
Really not Texas, not a chance. And then the whole Medicare thing, oh my God, you can't move there and just show up and end up taking money from the coffers. So yeah, they would be very, is the word reticent to let his partner move from Indiana and then immediately end up starting collecting a check benefits. And I don't mean this in any disparaging way whatsoever. If the guy's on disability, the guy's on disability. But Texas, I would imagine, they are not a fan of having somebody else show up, especially gay, living with a gay that's PFR. No.
Well, Google Allen County and find out. I didn't take the time to do that and find out if that's Podunk City or where it is. But it sounds like a bastion of progressive thinking to me, doesn't it, to you?
Yes. See, and I'm thinking Allen County is then in Indiana. There's an Allen, Texas. So I'm thinking it's Allen County, Indiana.
Well, we'll have to get this cleaned up. But anyway, I wanted to get it back on the radar because it had fallen
off. It is Allen County in Indiana. So that's what he's talking about. He's talking about him trying to move up there, calling the sheriff's office there in Indiana to try and figure out what the deal is going to be if he moves. And they're giving him the runaround, which is what I'm sure every PFR office does for the most part, is give everyone the runaround because they don't want you to move in there either. However, his partner lives next door to a park. So that's going to be negative right out of the gate.
You got that right. If you've interpreted it correctly, and I think you have, then he's going to have a tough road to overcome to get there. Because
but if that's it. Okay. So here, I'm going to put on my love counselor hat. If the two of you are made for this and he's inherited the house, then sell the house and move someplace where they can't mess with you and you have that 1,000-foot restriction and move there.
Well, tell me about Allen County. Where is it? What's the name of the county seat?
Oh, good grief. All right. Allen County is 2020 sentence. Hey, it's 385,000 people.
What's the county
seat? It's a county. I don't even know how to understand what county seat means. If I search for seat on Wikipedia,
yeah. If you're in the Wikipedia, it'll say the county.
Fort Wayne.
So okay.
And I'm assuming that's a good thing, being Fort Wayne, Indiana, right?
Well, being 385,000 people, that sheriff's department has the power to enough manpower to be thorough.
Okay, but wouldn't if it were 2,000 people, then they're going to be very aggressive about having a PFR to monitor. But 385 is a pretty substantial city.
It is a pretty substantial population. But nobody wants PFRs to come, period.
I gotcha. Okay, well, after we've noodled around with that for a little while, do you have any closing remarks before we head over to the main event?
The main event, let's do it.
All right, then. So this is a case that you put in here, you people have put in here, from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And I read it over. While I was driving back today, for 6 hours, I was reading this. And I see some justification for this case consuming FYP's valuable airtime. The issue is a habeas corpus. Now, how's that so far?
So far, so good. So keep going.
All right. The name of the case is Lewis Matthew Clements versus Secretary of the Department of Corrections. And in 2008, Clements pled guilty to a single count of lewd and lascivious conduct in violation of Florida statutes. He was sentenced to 5 years of PFR probation. No time, just PFR probation. The terms of which provided that he qualified and shall register with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement as a PFR pursuant to Florida Statute 943.0435.
Do we need to describe PFR probation a little bit?
We probably should, because if it's Florida, it's going to be worser than anywhere else.
So, well, in most instances, with the exception of those supervised in Houston County, Georgia.
I think that's a dig at me.
PFR probation is much stricter than any other form of community supervision. It involves frequent home visits, so-called treatment that involves the use of polygraph examinations, strict curfews, and really strict travel restrictions, except for Houston County, Georgia. So anybody who wants to be under lax supervision, transfer your PFR supervision to Houston County, Georgia.
All right. I can't really argue with this. In 2017, roughly 4 years after the expiration of his probation term, Clements proceeded pro se, filed his first 2254 petition in the United States District Court of Middle District of Florida, challenging his conviction on various grounds. The district court dismissed the petition for lack of jurisdiction, concluding that Clements' obligation to comply with Florida's registration and reporting requirements for PFRs did not place him in custody for habeas purposes. Now, did Clements appeal that denial?
He did. And on appeal, the Court of Appeals affirmed the district judge, holding with some hesitation that the restrictions on freedom of his movement imposed by Florida's lifetime registration and reporting requirements were not severe enough to place PFRs in custody under 2254, which is a federal law that limits habeas to a review of state convictions to those who are in custody. And that was reported as Clements versus Florida, and that's Clements 159. Federal 4th at 1204 to 1215, 11th Circuit. And a cert petition was filed with the United States Supreme Court, and it was denied.
All right, well then, do me a favor, please, and explain the significance of what the in-custody requirement is for habeas corpus.
Sure. in order to be able to utilize habeas corpus as a vehicle to seek judicial relief, a person must be in some form of custody. In custody is broadly interpreted to include probation and parole, but simply being on the PFR registry, I think, has been denied as custody, except in one federal circuit. And I didn't do the research, but I think one federal circuit has held that it does constitute custody. If it's not a federal circuit, it's a state court, but I think it's a federal circuit. But a person who is not in custody, if they're only required to register, they're not under any form of restraint on their liberties, according to the court. So therefore, you're not in custody. You're in a civil regulatory framework.
All right. During his first appeal, Clements argued for the first time in his pro se brief that the residency restrictions in Florida imposes on PFR contributed to his quote unquote being in custody. Now, what did they say in response to that argument?
Well, they actually declined to consider the impact of those restrictions because Clements had not raised the argument below in the district court, and the record was undeveloped as to that issue. And then they even refused to take judicial notice of how much land was covered by these residence restrictions without access to appropriate and detailed maps and plats. And they explained that without knowing where Florida schools, daycares, parks, and playgrounds were located, they could not sketch out the residency buffer zones as experts might do. And Clements did not provide the specifics necessary to evaluate the impact of these restrictions on appeal. Thus, they expressly reserved consideration of that issue for another day.
And that day has now arrived.
Correct. It has arrived.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, then in April of 2024, Clements filed his second pro se 2254 petition, again challenging the constitutionality of his conviction. This petition provides the basis for the instant appeal. Clements' petition included the explanation regarding lack of custody, which acknowledged the question left open in Clements 1. And Clements 1 is his first pro se whatever, right?
Right.
Okay. So open by Clements 1, and argued that because Florida restricted PFRs to living in only 50% of the state's land, the district court should conclude that he was, quote unquote, in custody for habeas purposes. Did the district court agree?
They did not.
Of course the district court.
The district court, acting on its own accord, dismissed Clements' petition for lack of jurisdiction. The court stated that Clements had failed to address his custody status or assert that it had changed, so it was bound by Clements 1's determination that he was not in custody. It noted the fact that Clements now believed he had a new basis to bring the 2254 petition did not alter the fact that the court was without jurisdiction to consider it. The district court basically flushed the case.
So Clements then moved for reconsideration and argued, among other things, that Clements 1 did not address the impact of the residency restrictions on his custody status. The district court denied Clements' motion. First, it stated that it would not ignore this court's binding decision in Clements 1 just because Clements had identified an alternate reason for why he was in custody. Second, the court found that Clements' motion merely restated the arguments in his petition, which was insufficient to carry his burden for reconsideration. So he appealed.
He did indeed.
And I think I've heard you pontificate that a certificate of appealability is required to file a second habeas. Am I losing my mind? Am I having amnesia way too early for my age?
No, you're not. I did mention that at some point in our relationship, and the court addressed that in footnote 1. They stated, ordinarily, a certificate of appealability is required to appeal the denial of a 2254 petition. And they cited the appropriate United States Code section. However, Clements was not required to obtain a COA in this instant case because his petition was dismissed for a lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And they cited Hubbard versus Campbell. And that's 379 Federal 3rd at 1245 to 1247. And that's a 2004 case from the 11th Circuit. So he didn't need to have a certificate of appealability. That's funny.
So what is the standard of review for this kind of appeal?
Well, the court answered that for us. They said, quote, we review de novo a district court's dismissal of a 2254 petition for lack of jurisdiction. And they cited Diaz versus Florida. And that's a 2012 case from the 11th Circuit.
If we can circle back, I'd like to focus a bit more on what, quote unquote, in custody means. The decision says federal courts may hear petitions for habeas relief filed by a person in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court only on the ground that he is in custody in violation of the Constitution or laws or treaties of the United States. Accordingly, federal courts lack jurisdiction to consider a 2254 petition from a petitioner who was not in custody at the time of filing. And that's citing Malang versus Cook, 490 U.S. 488, pages 490 and 491, and that's 1989. How was custody determined?
Well, section 2254A's custody requirement is construed very liberally. An individual need not be physically in prison to be in custody for habeas purpose, Jones versus Cunningham. And that's way back from 1963, U.S. Supreme Court. Instead, significant restraints on a person's liberty to do the things which, in this country, free men are entitled to do when the constraints are not shared by the public, generally. That can be sufficient to satisfy the in custody requirement. The relevant inquiry is whether a petitioner's actions and movements are substantially limited when looking at the cumulative effect of the restrictions on the petitioner's autonomy. Now, that's what I keep telling people about the registry. If you're free to come and go, just being registered is not enough. But the states that keep piling on these restrictions, they eventually are building a new vehicle for you to challenge aspects of the registry because you're in custody.
Now, this situation seems to be a no-brainer to me. PFRs in Florida have significant restraints on their liberty. Florida argued that Clements 1 was binding and that the matter had already been previously decided. What did the court say in response to that?
They said, contrary to the district court's belief, Clements 1 is not binding as to whether Clements is in custody for purposes of the instant petition. In the prior case, we expressly reserved consideration of the residency requirements for another day. As Clements had neither raised the argument in district court nor developed a complete factual record.
Now, do me a favor, repeat what you just said. I think you said something about development of a factual record.
I did. I said that Clements had neither raised the argument below in district court nor developed a complete factual record. You need to have a fully developed record when you go up on appeal. I mean, hello, folks. This is serious business. When you're in an appellate court, they don't develop the record. They review the record.
All right. So you're on a roll. Keep going.
They said Florida's PFR residence requirements are more than an alternate reason why Clements may be in custody for the purposes of the instant case. These restrictions present a potential custodial constraint on Clements' liberty, and our court explicitly left open the consideration of these restrictions. As such, the district court erred by not considering Clements' new in custody arguments and by sua sponte dismissing the petition before the state could even respond, thereby denying the parties the opportunity to fully develop their arguments regarding the impact of Florida's residence restrictions on Clements' custody status.
And what you're talking about there with fully developed is similar to the thing that we talk about all the time of a summary judgment?
Yes, that is not what, it's not exactly identical here in this habeas, but you've got to have the records developed below. The appellate courts are already reviewing the records. You don't get to admit new evidence. You get to argue about the evidence that was put into the record below.
All right. Well, then the court stated, we must now consider whether, despite the district court's error, The record on appeal is sufficiently developed for our court to resolve Clement's new in-custody arguments. Now, what did Clements do to better develop the record?
Well, Clements took the first step by arguing in his pro se filings that before the district court that Florida's PFR residence requirements, along with his registration and reporting requirements, sufficiently restrict his liberty as to so to render him in custody. They noted that now that he is represented by counsel, that's the court, they noted Clements maintains this argument but attempts to supplement his contentions by providing maps as well as citing studies and academic briefs, articles in his brief. However, much of the information is not part of the record on appeal because it was not first presented to the district court. You've got to let the district court have the first bite at the apple.
Now, it sounds like the record is still undeveloped. I've heard you say over the years that appellate courts do not admit new evidence. Did they allow it in this case?
They did not. They stated, we ordinarily do not review materials outside the record on appeal. And as an appellate court, we do not sit in as a collective trier of fact. We therefore decline to consider Clement's evidence regarding Florida's residence restrictions in the first instance and conclude that the record is undeveloped at this stage for meaningful review of the issues Clements presents on appeal.
Does that mean this case is going back to the district court for a third time?
It does mean that. The court said, we remand this case to the district court to permit the parties the opportunity to develop the record as to the restrictions imposed by Florida's residence requirements. The district court shall then rule on whether these residence restrictions, considered in combination with the registration and reporting requirements, render Clements in custody for habeas purposes. Mr. Clements, I know you're listening. Make sure that if your attorney isn't doing the job, that you don't let this case go up undeveloped. You probably won't get a fourth bite at the apple.
So. Well, but then by what is happening here, what do you think the court is telegraphing?
Oh, I actually think they're telegraphing that they're seriously considering the argument that being on Florida's PFR registry meets the in-custody requirements for federal habeas. And if they do that, if they come back with that decision and it holds up on appeal, that's going to be gargantuan. You would have another circuit to join that has said that it is in custody. And that's a brand new vehicle for people to use because they no longer have to be under supervision. They don't have to be in a hard custodial situation. They just have to merely be registered. So Florida, keep on amping up your registry requirements. Keep doing what you're doing, and you're going to be the downfall of the very thing that you're trying to protect, which is your precious registry. Isn't that funny?
Can you help me extrapolate that out to the people that live under bridges? Does this apply to them potentially?
I don't know if I follow the question. Under bridges, what does that have to do with anything?
Well, there are so many people, like from the, is it Untouchable? The documentary about Ron Book, they're all the people in Dade County, I guess it is, where they can't live anywhere, so they end up finding a place under a bridge somewhere that, because of the way the residency restrictions are, that they would fall, and then these people would be able to potentially find housing. Would this then give them relief?
Well, yes, now follow your question. If the ruling goes the way we hope, and this is determined to be in custody, and he gets to cite constitutional arguments. He gets to raise contingents on the Constitution of every aspect of the Florida registry because he now has a vehicle to use. And I think he's going to win this. I think the odds are better than 50-50 that this 11th Circuit is going to rule in his favor ultimately if the attorney doesn't botch this case.
Are you in a position to be in contact with? Do you know who that is?
I don't know. I could figure it out, but why would they listen to me? I don't have a law degree.
Yes, I understand that, Larry. I do that you don't have the letters. But that doesn't mean you don't know the arguments and the strategy and the opposing arguments and all that, that you couldn't be of great value to them.
Well, I might reach out if I can determine who it is. I'd have to do some work, but if Clements is listening, you can contact the program.
Yeah, no doubt. As he should be. And if anybody in Florida knows who this dude is, please point them in this direction so that he can get on board. Like, I'm assuming, Larry, that you could come up with all of the arguments that we should present and then what the opposing side would present in return. I'm assuming you could put that together.
Oh, well, I think I could because I know what they're going to do. They're going to argue and argue and argue that he's not in custody. And they're going to argue and argue that their registry is merely civil, non-punitive, and regulatory. And these all these restrictions are narrowly tailored.
So, like, one of my big deals, Larry, was that can I go see a movie? I enjoy going to the movie theater. I like the big sound. I like sitting down with a big-ass box of popcorn. But when I was on supervision, at least at the very beginning, I was not going anywhere near a movie theater, even for a during the school day matinee where there wouldn't be any kids there or anything like that, and going to see like an R-rated movie, no kids allowed. But to me, since I couldn't go, that sounds to be more like a disability and a restraint. That sounds more like being in custody because you sure as heck can't go to a movie while you're in prison. So like, that's just one of those things that you probably shouldn't do is go see a movie, particularly one that has, like, you know, even if it's adult, like a Pixar kind of movie that has Shrek and adult jokes in it, but kids still end up there. Like, it's just not a wise place to go. But that's just an example I'm giving to say disability and restraint.
Indeed. And again, Florida legislature, listen carefully. All legislatures around the country, listen carefully. You can do almost anything. But you have to narrowly tailor it. You can't apply it to all PFRs. If you'll contact me for a minor fee, I will help you draft narrowly tailored legislation that will withstand constitutional challenge. But you have to target those restrictions by going to the picture show to a person who's offended against a minor, and more recently than decades ago. But you can do almost anything if you narrowly tailor it.
But that requires work for them to individually evaluate you to what your restrictions should be.
Well, in addition to that, more importantly, it doesn't play to the political machine. The victims advocates and the law enforcement apparatus, they do not want to hear about narrow tailoring. They will tell you that there's bracket creep, you know, which I'm using that term loosely, but they just because they didn't offend against a child originally, that they progress and they escalate and they do all these things. So they want this. You could never pass anything that's sufficiently narrowly tailored because it wouldn't make the victim's apparatus happy.
I gotcha. Now, someone posted in chat, they said that they think that their 2019 decision, the Third Circuit ruled that individuals required to register as PFRs in Pennsylvania were considered quote unquote in custody for habeas purposes. Thereby allowing them to seek federal habeas. And he says that the case number is Piasecki versus Court of Common Pleas.
I think I remember that. I think that's exactly where I remember it being from, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, there you go. It's in the show notes for you to reference at your leisure.
Thank you.
Well,
thank
you
the vast research of our audience.
Yeah, that is from 010 Brands. All right, well, then you put this article in here from the AP, which has got to be the most left-leaning publication ever. It says the California Supreme Court handed down two decisions last week that could impact decades of sentencing for gang-related offenses and allowing thousands of people to petition courts to re-examine their cases. That sounds like a bunch of liberal do-gooders turning loose a tidal wave of crime on innocent Californians to me.
So what do you expect from that place? It's governed by communists who only care about power, not the people. But I put this in here for the sole purpose of making the point as we go through this. Keep in mind that gangsters are probably on the pecking order, like number two or three below PFRs. So if a bunch of liberal do-gooders, communist sympathizers can rule in favor of them, it's possible that we might get some good rulings out of the California Supreme Court for us. So that's why I put it in here. It's hope. But anyway, go ahead.
Both rulings examined a 2021 law that raised the standard of evidence for proving that someone broke a law as part of criminal street gang activity. In different ways, the Supreme Court chose to apply the new standard to past convictions. One decision took an incarcerated person off of death row, The other sided with two incarcerated people who contested past strikes on their record that set them on a course for lengthy sentences. Now, can you believe this? They're siding with career criminals?
Well, not so fast here. It's uncertain how far-reaching these two rulings will be. Both of them came in split decisions reflecting disagreements about how to apply the 2021 law. In one case, a 4-3 majority determined that prior gang-related charges did not hold up under the new legal standards and thus could not be used as strikes. Larry Fletcher and Eric Anthony Taylor Jr. argued that 2015 gang enhancement convictions could not be applied as strikes toward three strikes sentence for a 2020 attempted murder, as their convictions were still under appeal when the 2021 law took effect. It remains unclear exactly how Fletcher and Taylor decision will set precedent for other individuals looking to reverse sentences under the three strikes law, but it does have the potential to let people out of prison.
Chief Justice Patricia Guerrero dissented from the decision. She admonished her fellow justices for invoking the authority to change the three strikes law under the guise of interpreting it. A second case ruled on Thursday upended a defendant's death sentence and remanded his case back to trial court. The case was decided 5-2, upholding Jason, Aguirre?
Aguirre, that's good enough.
Aguirre? Jason Aguirre's 2009 murder and attempted murder convictions, but sending it back to trial court in Orange County for what the court described as further proceedings. Both the majority and dissenting opinions said they would have reversed the defendant's gang enhancements.
Yeah, you can see what these liberals are doing. They're no wonder. The Aguirre was in his late 20s, a white man who prosecutors allege hung out with a Vietnamese youth gang called Dragon Family Jr. in Orange County. One night in 2003, he and a few younger accomplices chased a group of people from a restaurant to a cul-de-sac where members of the group crashed their car. Aguirre shot three of them, and one, a 13-year-old Minh Tran, died. At trial, a detective testified that Aguirre shot three people for the reputational benefit of the gang. At the time, that was a valid reason for a prosecutor to pursue gang enhancements to a defendant's sentence. That's the kind of person I would want to live in my community, wouldn't you?
Without a doubt. So then in 2021, the law changed that. Now the law says that the gang enhancements have to show that any benefit the gang received from criminal activity has to be more than just reputational. I don't understand what that means.
Well, I guess they're saying just going out killing somebody to establish a reputation. I guess that's what they're saying, but I don't really understand it either. But it was noted when the trial took place, the defendant's jury was not given instructions that track the revised language of the 2021 law. Guerrero wrote in the majority opinion, with the relevant aspects of Assembly Bill 333, the 2021 law, applying retroactively, this disconnect with the law as it has since been amended constitutes error affecting defendant's conviction for active participation in a street gang. So they're just looking for a way to turn these criminals loose.
I see. Aren't gang enhancements pretty common across the country?
Yes, gang enhancements and so-called three-strike laws date back decades to when California's crime numbers were peaking in the late 80s and early 90s. State legislators in 1988 enacted the Street Terrorism Enforcement and Prevention, known as the STEP Act, in response to rising gang and crime violence, notably most visible in Los Angeles neighborhoods. Participation or association with alleged gang or gang members became highly subjective criminal acts that added sentencing enhancements for felonies committed to benefit a criminal street gang. Then during the era of so-called super predator, voters in 2000 approved Proposition 21, which expanded provisions of the STEP Act to increase mandatory sentencing for gang-related crimes. And that's why when their prisons got so overcrowded out there.
I see. And it's what the people demanded. Over the next two decades, local prosecutors in California pursued allegations of criminal street gang activity for both violent and nonviolent felony charges.
They did. And critics, activists, and reform advocates argued that gang allegations and gang enhancements disproportionately and unfairly targeted defendants from minority and low-income communities, and that the low thresholds of evidence led to prejudiced juries and resulting in disproportionately severe sentences, primarily for people of color.
I can see it from that perspective, of course. The article notes that in 2021, the Step Forward Act, legislation authored by then-Assembly member Sidney Kumlager-Dove of Los Angeles, attempted to address the inequities and excessive punitive impact of the original STEP Act and its amendments. The STEP Forward Act is the law at the center of the two new California Supreme Court rulings.
That is correct. But critics also say that current gang enhancement statutes criminalize entire neighborhoods historically impacted by poverty, racial inequality, and mass incarceration as they punish people based on cultural identity, who they know and where they live. I'm not so sure I completely understand that. I'm going to have a little broader education on that. I don't know how you punish a whole neighborhood, but maybe somebody can enlighten us.
Maybe. Okay. So where else do we go from here? Is that all you want to do with this particular article?
It is. I think we've got all the content on the agenda done. And like I say, this is tangentially connected. If they're willing to turn loose the tidal wave of crime of gangsters, it's clear that they're not worried about their reelection very much.
Would that be because, I don't know, what is it, like an 80% blue state?
I don't know that I can say that, but it certainly is a blue state at the moment.
I see. Well, it seems like they would have to all be the communists to let forth the tidal wave of crime. Because, you know, they're all moving from California to Texas, right?
Well, and of course, you know that liberals don't care about people. They care about power. You understand that, don't you?
I've heard something about that, too. Yes, of course.
Yeah, yes, so.
Well, I do want to mention, Larry, now that we're closing out the show, that we have two fine new patrons. One is named James and another is Joel. I would like to welcome them both to the FYP family. Roo, roo, rah, 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 and applause and all that fun stuff. Thank you guys for coming on board.
Did they come on at stimulus level?
Pretty close. One of them was much closer than the other one, but the other one was quite generous as well.
All right. Thank you.
Head over to registrymatters.co for show notes and email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Even while I'm sitting on the beach, I will pick up your email and I will forward it to Larry. Leave an old-fashioned voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And please, as James and Joel have done, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/registrymatters. Takes a lot of time and effort to put the work into to make these programs, and every little penny helps show the support and love for this. So if you would be so kind to join us on Patreon, that would be immensely appreciated. Head over to fypeducation.org/shop to find some merch, t-shirts, and particularly the Kabuki machine. It's fantastic merch. Anything else? What are you doing this weekend, Larry?
Well, I'm going home to visit with my kitty cat.
All right, then. Fantastic. Well, I hope everybody has a great night and a good weekend, and stay warm or cool depending on where you are and what the weather is. I hope it's all fantastic for you. And I will talk to you soon, my friend.
7 in the morning.
Of course.
Good
Take
night.
Care, man. Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.